Hello and welcome to the September 9th edition of the TMS Wiki's weekly Tuesday night discussion group. This week we are continuing working through The Meaning of Truth, Embrace Your Truth, Create Your Life by Nicole Sachs, LCSW. And this week we are covering chapters 6 and chapter 7. Now, chapter 6 is quite long, so depending on how deep we decide to go into those sections, we may or may not get to chapter 7. Today we are happy to have not just one therapist, but two therapists on the line. We have both Nicole and her mother, from whom I gather she learned a tremendous amount and had some excellent discussions throughout her life with about the nature of truth. And so possibly at some point we can ask her some questions about that as well. So I'm very excited about that. I should say, however, that we are all coming together in this book group. This is really a book group. It isn't psychotherapy. We come together as peers. No one here is acting as a practitioner. You don't want to try and get medical advice from here. If you have medical concerns, see a doctor, preferably a TMS doctor. You know, we're just sharing advice. So if you need a therapist or a medical mental health one, there are plenty that you can find on our directory of TMS therapists. Nicole herself is, I believe, on that list as well.
I should hope so.
I should hope so. Well, some people take themselves off. You know, everybody has their thing. But so let us begin. Let's talk about some of those examples. By the way, today we have on the line Eric Herbie Watson, my co-host of this podcast. You want to say hello, Eric?
Hello, everybody.
Eric, where's your picture? I like seeing your smiling face.
I'm still dealing with technical difficulties.
Oh, man. All right. Well, your voice is better than nothing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks.
And a relaxing and reassuring voice it is. All right, so let's just power through these examples. Now, the next example I wanted to talk about has to do with a movie specifically.
I love this one. By the way, I have to tell you something.
Yes.
This is my favorite example.
Is it really? It's so powerful.
This is my favorite example. It was a late addition to the book in one of the later edits before it was published. And I love this example because the story I tell about having watched the movie and literally sitting up straight in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and being like, it's all completely true, and it's a fabulous example of how this work is timeless. Because people sometimes think, oh yeah, well just, you know, we're just starting to realize how pain can be psychosomatically, you know, have a psychosomatic origin, even though our pain is obviously tremendously real and sometimes paralyzing. And I just loved that I was sitting, I'm jumping ahead, but we're going to go back. But I loved that when I was watching her, if anyone has seen the movie, it's so powerful, sitting in the chair during basically the birth of psychoanalysis with Jung, and screaming about her most disgusting, ugly truths, and me knowing, that so many people, just laymen watching this movie, are thinking, oh, she's about to be, you know, electric shock treatment. She's about to be completely slayed. And the next scene, she's in medical school and she's fine.
Right.
And it's like, yes, you know, and that to me. I mean, have you seen the movie for us?
I have not, but now I really want to. It's in my Netflix DVD queue.
You must see the movie because
it sounds wonderful.
So anyway, you go, let's back, you know, let's rewind. And I would like to hear what you wanted to introduce from having read that example.
Well, I mean, I think one thing might be valuable in that is just having you tell the story, because you tell stories wonderfully. But you know, just the basic outline of the story. Do you want to tell us, you know, the basic outline, focusing on what's most important? We might lose our PG rating, so those who are
offended. We lose our PG rating the moment you invite me in the room, so let's not.
That's,
you know,
true. I think that might be correct, yes.
Well, most people at this point on the call know that I swear like a sailor, but it's always for good reason. It's always for good reason. Okay, so let me just, I'm referencing my own book because I want to make sure. Okay, so here's the situation. I wrote the examples chapter of this book, and one day, not today, I will share with you the example that I removed. What happened was I had another example that both my some of the professors I was working with to help me edit the book and my mother felt was too controversial and would I would lose my message. So I took it out. And I was trying to decide, because I have, you know, endless client examples and also all the people I met while speaking on the panel all those years with Dr. Sarno. So I knew I could find something to replace this rather controversial example. And what happened was, just that night, I was just happened to be looking for something to watch on TV. And we put on this movie, and now I'm completely spacing on the actual name of the movie, which is why I'm looking in my own book. The Dangerous Method. Okay. So The Dangerous Method was the story, and it's the true story, of how Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung became colleagues and friends. Both, you know, two of the masterminds of modern-day psychoanalysis and psychotherapeutic study, and what's become actually when I studied, and I think now still called psychodynamic study. And the first people to ever decide that this thing called like the talking method, you know, this was the birth of people really understanding that talking about your feelings matters. It's not just about going into hospital and getting, you know, electric shock or things that would, you know, alter your brain. It actually matters to express yourself. And these were two of the pioneers, you know, Jung and Freud, in this endeavor. And so in this movie, they have, it's a completely true story because she was also one of Carl Jung's lovers. And I don't know if he ever married her, but a significant woman in his life was Sabina Spielrein, who was a Jewish woman who was very brilliant, living in, I guess it's either Germany or Austria. I don't actually remember this. I haven't seen this movie since the day I wrote this. But the point is that she is considered insane. She was raised by a very wealthy family. She had gone to the best boarding schools, and, you know, she was an educated woman. And she was considered insane because her behavior was insane. I mean, she ripped off all her clothes and swam in the pond and flipped everybody off. I mean, she was extremely volatile, certainly for a woman in those times. But what was fascinating was that Carl Jung was interested in her. He didn't think that her insanity was the end of the story. So he took her on as a patient, and instead of just, you know, putting her behind bars and putting her in a straitjacket, they took walks along, you know, in the gardens of this asylum, and he spoke to her, and he and Freud had this theory that if people can speak about their feelings and really unearth their deepest feelings rooted in childhood, which is, you know, Freud, everyone knows Freud, you know, the Oedipus complex, all the dilemmas, that they could be helped. And so they had this theory that, and this is something that I don't do, but I know that a lot of psychoanalysts do, that the patient shouldn't face the therapist, shouldn't have to have eye contact, should have the freedom to really bring out, you know, the dirty uglies that we always talk about in TMS that can be a real lifesaver, to just be able to, you know, kind of spill our most shameful things. So there's the reason I wrote this example is there's a scene in the movie where you're basically ready to commit this woman for the rest of her life as the viewer. She's completely, you know, out of control. She's doing really inappropriate things. And he has her in the chair and she's facing away from him. And he's asking her about her childhood. And he's asking her about the memories she has of her father beating her for spilling milk. And she would spill milk, and she was 4 or 5 years old, or very, very young. And he would take her into this small room that she remembers as the room where people were beaten. And I'm using creative license here in remembering, but it's very close to the actual storyline. And he would take her clothes off, and he would beat her bare bottom. And he and Jung was asking her, and he was kind of soliciting for her to be able to share how horrible this was for her, or how devastating. And what ended up happening is in her screaming, crying, retching fit, she said, "I was excited." And he said, "What?" And she said, "I was sexually excited. I enjoyed him beating me." And she said it in such a way. I mean, it was almost like you were watching her trying not to vomit. It was so poignant how violent the scene was in this movie. And at the end of the scene, they just cut. You know, she says these things that most of us would never say out loud. This is the bottom line of so many things I talk about in relieving our TMS. You know, she had a very awful, violent example. Some of us have those examples. Some of us don't. Some of our examples are just shameful things that we find shameful because of our family of origin that aren't even really that publicly difficult to say. But in any case, I was watching the movie and I knew what was going to happen next. And I couldn't believe, because I knew that probably a lot of people would think next would be like the scene where she's like in shackles. I mean, it was. And the next scene is that she is walking out of medical school in her second or third year, you know, with her books, and she's all, because she just needed to purge that very shameful truth that she was beaten, but instead of being beaten down, it excited her and she felt like disgusting. She said, "I'm disgusting. I'm reprehensible. I don't belong in the human race. You know, I should be killed. I should be stuck." She said, "I should be stuck in this asylum for the rest of my life for thinking how disgusting I am." And then all of a sudden she is in history. This is a real person. One of, I think, the most famous female psychoanalyst, and she was a psychiatrist, a MD, of all time. I mean, it's crazy. So anyway, that was what, you know, basically put me on the path of saying, I need to say this because it is a beautiful example of truth and what we all need to do on our own personal levels to get rid of this bullshit TMS. You know, and not to say that TMS is bullshit, meaning it's not true. It's pain we don't need to have. So anyway, I don't know. Is that too wordy of an answer? It's a passionate subject for me.
So. And the passion really comes through. Absolutely. Yeah. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me a lot of the story of Helen in The Mind-Body Prescription. I think it might show up. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us that story? Well, I mean, I guess the parallel there is you've got this ancient, terribly traumatic physical and sexual trauma from a family member, and then kind of that explosive feeling of repression and then letting it out.
I mean, I'd say, Forrest, first of all, before I just go on and on again, because I know I can just go on and on, I see on the chat, Eric, does anybody want to like weigh in before I just talk more? I like to talk, don't get me wrong, but I do want it to be a discussion group. I don't want it to be a monologue. So if anybody...
Yeah, I got a question about on page 138 from Sabina. Yeah.
Shoot, let's hear it.
And it's a book discussion, right? She's not ready. Okay. It says on page 138, Sabina wasn't bad. She was drowning in her own shame. The holding it down part was the madness and not the truth.
Yes.
I'm not going to try to elaborate on this. Could you elaborate on this?
Yes.
The holding it down, the last part, the holding it down part, and I would assume that's her shame. The holding it down part was the madness and not the truth. And yes. If she was holding down the shame, then that was the madness, right?
Yes. Yes. Eric.
Okay. And now, could you reveal to us the truth?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Thanks.
I'm on a different page than you because I have the hardcover in front of me and all the books are different. So give me 2 seconds. But I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's page 128 in my paperback.
Okay, 128.
Okay, I got it on Kindle, so yeah.
Oh yeah. It's what's the problem with these days of all of us having different
Yeah,
give me a second.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
I don't have the paperback with me. Okay. All right. I remember though. Okay. So, but what Herbie Eric is saying is something incredibly important, and it doesn't really matter what page you're on because this is just so important for every one of us. Anyone who's on this call, it is important for you. She, let's, we're going to use Sabina. I can use anyone. I can use myself, but I will use her because we're talking about her. She was holding down the disgusting truth that when her father beat her naked, it made her sexually excited. And what I write in the book is, dude, that's horrible to hear. Like, I was rocked by it. And if I was rocked by it, everybody was, because it takes a lot to rock me. And that's just a very upsetting thing to think about a human being. However, it doesn't matter. What is your truth is your truth. And if you are going to push it down with shame, embarrassment, fear, rage, whatever it is that keeps you hiding, whatever that dirty ugly is of yours, the problem is that is what causes the TMS. So Eric, to your question, the pushing down was what kept her insane and hurting. The letting it out was the truth. But it's so rare to have the safety. Back then it was incredibly, impossibly rare. Now we have much more safety in our lives to tell these things that are truths that seem so ugly. I'll give you a very quick example. I have a client who was incredibly heinously sexually abused as a child at the hands of her father. And I have her now in her 50s, and she is working through it for the first time in her life. And she has a daughter who is a grown woman who she is incredibly close with. They have a great relationship. There's never been one second of abuse the whole time. And they went on vacation together about a year ago, and I didn't hear about this, of course, till she came back from vacation, came back into session, shared with me that she had a horrible night of panic and no sleep because she had this bizarre feeling that she might sexually abuse her daughter, which is, it's so insane to think, because this, first of all, this woman would never, she's a wonderful person, has never done anything like that her whole life, would never, she and her daughter have a beautiful relationship. So I want to make sure to say that. But I said, okay, instead of being horrified, I said, okay, let's talk about that. You were so horribly abused. This is a natural reaction. Your brain is messing with you and putting thoughts in your head, and you need to say it out loud. We need to just say it. And it was so powerful because she just sobbed and she cried and she was so grateful. And she said, I just needed to say it. I never want to do that. I don't even have the slightest inkling to do that. But it came in my head and it made me so disgusted with myself. She said, I was panicking all night. I didn't sleep all night. I was shaking. As soon as we talked about it, it was over for her.
It's like they think it, that's them, but it's really not. And then when they admit it, they're set free.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Eric, that is exactly right. The freedom comes directly from not being afraid. I mean, think about how disgusting that must have felt for her. I mean, this is a child she's raised alone. She's a single parent. There's nothing about her child that has ever involved abuse. But because she had this horrible moment, which most likely was just a flashback of her own past, this was not something that she desired to do, but the thought that it even entered her brain upset her so much that if she had not had a place to put that, if she could not come into my office and safely say, I can't believe I'm about to say this to you, but this is what I thought, that could have caused TMS for her off the charts. Right? I mean, don't you agree, Eric?
Yes.
Holding that kind of horrible thought down. What's that?
This is real good, because I'm thinking about Sabina, as you're saying this. And, you know, you mentioned the other lady. And I'm thinking the very next scene you was talking about, she was going to school. She went on to become one of the, you know, the best well-known women psychiatrists of all time. And it was because she'd been holding in on the inside that she was just this shameful, dirty person.
That's right.
And then when she revealed that truth, she found out that really wasn't her identification. That really wasn't who she was.
Exactly. You're so wise. And that is exactly right. That did not define her. That did not define her. But without admitting it and getting someone to be like, all right, you know, when my client came in and said that, I immediately forgave her. I said, honey, you know you don't want to do that. And she goes, oh, God, no. And I said, okay. I said, so, you know, listen, horrible things were done to you. Horrible things. So that's the past. And this man is dead. And thank God, because he was horrible. But the point is, that doesn't define you. And the moment we said it, it was over. I've been seeing her for 4 years, and that story was a year ago. We haven't talked about it since because it's not an issue for her because it didn't become an issue because she just said it and we dissolved it right there. It like I say in my book, it evaporates into the air. As soon as we just say, oh, God, that's disgusting. I'm like that. And someone else can say, you know what? Or you can say to yourself, you're all right. You know, you're not like that. You're just that something really horrible, shitty happened to you. And you need to say, I forgive myself for having the thought. And clearly, in the case of Sabina, in my book, she needed to scream that out loud. And for Young to just be sitting there and being like, all right, well, okay. And she was like, I don't know what happened after, but I know that 2 years later, she's basically graduating as a psychiatrist. So she wasn't in the, she said in, you guys should see the movie, but she says in that scene, I'm disgusting. I remember she's saying something like, I deserve to be locked up in here for the rest of my life. And the difference between that and being one of the preeminent women psychiatrists of all time, a little different. All because of truth.
I did a little bit of research on the story afterwards that the director noted that back in that time in Vienna, they had mailed or wherever it was, they had mail delivery 7 times per day. So it was almost email. That would be how they would communicate. And right. So they didn't have a phone. So you could send an email in the morning and get a reply in the afternoon. And being some of the parents of psychoanalysis, they wrote a great deal about this, so there was quite a historical record to go off of as well.
Yeah.
He said every line of dialogue he could point to a letter because they found her letters at one point. And then, unfortunately, later on during the Holocaust, she was killed.
Yeah, she died, and it's very tragic. It's tragic her ending that she died in the Holocaust. But she, what to me would have been much more tragic, is that the 20-year-old her would have been locked up for the rest of her life because of a truth that she didn't have to live out in shame. And so, as you know, I am Jewish, and my father's father was in a work camp, and I'm very familiar. My family is connected quite a bit to the Holocaust, and I will say, as horrible as it is that she died there, I'm glad that she did the work and got to do what she did before that. And that's because she was able to speak her truth.
Powerful stuff. Final thoughts on that story? Going to move things along, but any final questions?
Yeah, I have one or a thought on it.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Nicole. I'm glad you mentioned final resolution of Sabina, unfortunately. Same thing happened to all my relatives except for about 1.5 of them. And I'd just like to mention today there's a modern Holocaust going on, which is rather underplayed by the media, where I get bits and pieces of it where Christians are being killed and Muslims are killing fellow Muslims. And it's being reported, but underplayed, I believe. So it's all over. And if they're being killed, I got to assume in those places, Syria and Iraq and those places, what's happening to the Jews there if they're killing the Christians. So just wanted to mention there Holocaust going on at this moment.
Yeah, yes, sir. It's horrible.
Historical connections. All right. Well, let's move on to the next story. Now, how much can you tell? Can you talk about Lucy? I know that there may be some confidentiality issues. Can you talk much about that, or are you going to need to?
Well, I mean, I published it in the book, so I can talk about the example. That's what I can.
Okay.
I mean, and I remember sharing this with you either last week or the week before, you meaning all of you guys, that my examples are all completely true to letter, but they're a conglomeration of people. Lucy is not one person. Lucy's about four people. And the reason is because we're all, like I spend a lot of time in my book saying this, we're all members of the human race. We're all partners in this thing called life. So we're really not all that different. And so it wasn't hard for me to look at my clientele and my history of working with people through Dr. Sarno and picking things to create a human being that was each of them, but never could be identified, and of course the name is just made up, that never could be identified as any of them, even though pretty much every one of my clients, because they're so lovely and because they're so appreciative of how much they've healed, has said to me, use me, use me, use me. I'm still very, very respectful and cognizant of the amount of information I give. But I can talk about Lucy because Lucy has become a person. You know, I mean, when we write about things and we embody real human characteristics, people become real. And everything about her is real. They're just not all, to one person. You know, do you know what I'm saying?
In some sense, she's more than one person. Like, the first question I wanted to ask was about the word fine. Lucy, and we'll go into why later on, but Lucy wants to keep things fine. And she says, she's describing an interaction she had with her boyfriend, and how she had to pacify him and put her needs below his. And you said, how was it? And she said, no, you asked if it was terrible. She said, no, it was okay. By then it was fine. And then in an author's note, you write, I sit daily across from you and hear you tell me that you are fine. I hate the word fine. Do you feel fine, really? Is all of this, whatever it is, okay with you? Tell us about that. Because I'm sure that happens a lot.
Yeah. Whomever is listening, and I'm not asking anyone specifically, I just want to, I don't want it to be a monologue. I want to engage people. Before I answer Forrest's question, I want to know if anybody can weigh in on that. If anybody can tell me why they think it's a problem in our society that we are of a knee jerk of, hey, how you doing? I'm fine. How are you? Now, I know that that can just be like, you know, banter, you know, if you're seeing somebody at the school pickup line, but I'm talking about our real friends and our real family and people that we confide in and see as our support systems. So I just wonder if anybody wanted to just kind of weigh in why I would have such a problem with fine.
The way I grew up,
yeah.
You said you was fine. That was just what you said, that you said you was fine to everybody, even if they were your close friends. You never spilled, you know, your guts out to nobody. You know, some people call it venting. But, as a guy, if I was going to vent to other guys, it was always going to be about, it wasn't going to be venting much, believe me. It was like sissy. It was like being a sissy or something. If a guy vented to another guy and wanted to tell our deep, dark truths, then, you know, we would hold it in. We'd never tell. It was like a taboo.
Correct.
It was like, you know, don't say that. You know, don't even go there. Don't even think to go there, because he's probably been through it too. And we really don't even want to talk about it. But at the same time, it was never brought up. We was always fine. Even when I got older, I don't ever remember, you know, in my 20s, 30s, even now, telling anybody, even when I'm feeling terrible, I don't never remember telling somebody I feel fine. But I know now it's not about getting to the deeper, darker truths, but you know, if the case was a few years, you know, in the making, and I still had TMS, then I would have to understand all of this. So I wouldn't be fine, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it is, you know, most people, that word fine to them, you know, the way I'm looking at it in the book and the way you saw it and the way she said it in the book, she told you she was fine, and you knew she wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the point. That was where you had to go in right there, right, as the super badass therapist. you get my point? I mean, that's where you had to go in. That's where you needed to do.
That's right. And you know what? And that's not easy for me, because sometimes I have to say, hey, guess what? I don't think you're fine.
That's right.
And at this point, everyone's used to me. So at least my regular clients, they walk in, they're like, oh, I wasn't going to tell you this, but I have to tell you. No, anyway. So, you know, we have a lot of conversations like that. But thank you for your input, Eric, because that's kind of why I wanted to open it up and share, because I think we all know the answer to this, which is we all say we're fine when we're not fine. And that's okay in social situations. I do it too. I'm not going to sit and pour my guts out to the, you know, the person standing behind me on the volunteer ice cream scoop line at Rehoboth Elementary School. You know, I don't want to. It's not the time, and it's fine. But it's fine. But when it's someone who will really listen to you and someone you should be able to trust and the support you really need in your life, if someone says, are you suffering? Are you okay? And you're like, oh, I'm good. No worries. It's awesome. I'm fine. That TMS will eat you alive, because that is going to be pushed down, pushed down, pushed down. And then wherever your weakness is, it's going to come out. Now, I'm not saying that we need to vent our, and this is the whole point of my book, you do not need to vent to the public. You can be that same person if that matters to you, which it's okay if it does. That you have a reputation for being like Mr. Macho or Miss Fine or I've got it all under control. That's why the journal is important, and potentially a therapeutic relationship is important, because there's got to be somewhere to put that. And that's why I try to help people befriend themselves in the journal speak process, because not everyone can afford psychotherapy nor find the right psychotherapist, and not everyone can trust their friends or their spouse with this kind of information. But if you can befriend yourself and allow yourself to, you know, have this quiet time and share the innermost feelings you have with yourself, you can live pain-free. I've seen, and anyone who's suffering in pain, I know they're sitting there and being like, oh, you know, that's a pipe dream. But I worked with Dr. Sarno for years at NYU. I'm doing this work in my office for years. I've seen it time and time and time again. It works. Forrest is an example. Eric is an example. I am an example. And so many others are. And I don't have one client, not one client in my practice who isn't improving. Some are improving at a greater speed than others that are embracing the work, and that's okay. But I don't have one client who's not improving.
I think I saw Mimi. Were you nodding along when she was talking about a place to share those things? Do you want to add? Feel free to pass.
Well, I just agree that saying you're fine when you're actually not fine is inviting pain, certainly mental pain, and also possibly physical pain. But I think people don't realize that they have to say to themselves, there's some disgusting thing about me that I have to recognize, or there's something that I do not want to admit that is part of myself. And by admitting it to yourself, that's half your battle, because that gives you knowledge. And once you have that knowledge and you see that lightning doesn't strike and the world suddenly might look like a better place, well, that is something that will make you stronger and will make you more confident in your ability to control those feelings and to control your reputation as well, because saying you're fine or just saying everything is okay and trying to make yourself believe it because you think that's the right thing to do or that's going to make you look good in the world, that's the beginning of your problem That's the problem that I think Nicole is trying to intercede and change.
Yeah. Well said. Right on, Mama.
Well said. Anyone else want to jump in on that? Any thoughts on, well, okay, any thoughts on that? And if not, then we'll continue on with Lucy.
I want to say something. I thought it did something great today when I talked to you today, Forrest.
Sure.
Usually, if I've had a hard situation or a hard time with somebody in my family, then I won't tell nobody. That's between me and them, and I don't talk about it. I don't say anything about it, you know. And one of the things I told you today is that my mother-in-law wasn't as lovely as I thought, you know. And really, it's kind of universal with some people. Some people just don't get along with their mother-in-laws. But at the same time, that's something that I never would have said. Mm-hmm. That's something that in the past I wouldn't have said to nobody. I would have painted a picture like I had the perfect mother-in-law. And I would have sat there and I would have created that as a reality, as a fake reality.
Right.
But you know, I told you today that she wasn't as lovely as I thought. And when I said that was me just being true to myself, you know, and I wasn't holding it in. And in a way, I was getting the vent, you know, because you asked me how I was and how was everything. And, you know, just sort of keeping in the same theme here, I was using that, you know. I mean, it wasn't something deep and too dark, but at the same time, to me, it was real dark. You know, I mean, I was in darkness, man.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, I've been kind of...
I never want to judge themselves based on how dark or not dark their truth is. Like, you know, I think that's wonderful. I have a client, Eric, who came to me about a year ago. I've been seeing him for about 3 years. He came to me about a year ago, and he's like, he lives with his mother-in-law. And he said, you know what? I don't like her. And I said, all right then. He's like, I just don't like her, and I'm not going to like her. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, I'm not going to treat her rude, and I'm not going to be any different toward her, but I don't like her, and I don't have to like her. And it was, like, huge for him. And I was like, she sounds really unlikable. Go for it, dude. Don't like her. You know, like, but people need permission. They need you to just say it out loud.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad you said that to me, Herbie. And I got to say, it was nice because we were having a real conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, of course, you know, for about 2 months, I told you that she was the best in the world. And then, you know, there before today, I told you that it wasn't like it was. And then today, I just came out and told you that, you know, she wasn't that lovely. But anyway, that's as far as it went. But it was just me telling Forrest in our own little, you know, in our own little talk that it wasn't that great. So we just kind of smoothed it over, and I got to get it out, in other words, and say, Forrest, I wasn't telling you all the truth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I totally see what you mean, and I think that's, like, really important because I think that we are a society of ashamed people. And I count myself among them. I am not perfect. Just because I wrote this book, I still struggle every day with my own versions of my TMS. And I struggle to be as truthful as I can with myself, with my family, with my friends, because it doesn't help not to. And we all need to always learn it the hard way. Nobody just decides to do that. But it's still important. And it's important to talk about it. And I think it's great that you brought it up.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Herbie. Eric.
First, if I can, on the subject of, in my neck of the woods, the hot tub, most of the discussion is about future or past joint replacement surgeries. There's never any discussion about anything really relevant, like religion, sex, or politics. Those are taboo subjects. But almost all the talk is about surgery and stuff. Never any discussion about affective TMS symptoms like depression or chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia. It's always body parts.
Maybe the two are connected. Maybe if they talked about their emotions, they wouldn't have to talk about surgery as much because they wouldn't have as much to talk about.
Oh, yeah, surgery. Absolutely.
Travesty. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, that's they believe in surgery is going to cure all their problems. And, you know, I just look at them and I've mentioned TMS to some. And a number of these people are psychotherapists. And usually I just kind of don't even bother getting into the conversation because it's so superficial. And they see me there reading Steve-O or Nicole. And they ask, oh, what are you reading? And I'll say it's a book about psychosomatic medicine, or I'll say it's a book about mind-body medicine, and this is in the heartland of, you know, New Age thought. And when it's a psychotherapist, I say, have you ever heard of Dr. Sarno? They say, no, and there's no interest whatsoever. And I just come to the conclusion most of them want to be white coats, and they want to ally themselves with, you know, doctors. Rather than the mind part of it, they want to be involved, you know, ally themselves with the body part of psychotherapy. So,
well, yeah. I think, you know, Tom, I think you make a good point. And here's what I have. I have actually something to say about this. Dr. Sarno often said to us as a group when we were all together at our panels that he didn't feel like it was appropriate to just, like, spew whatever this kind of information to everyone because not everyone's like ready to hear it. And I think that it's frustrating. And I have actually, I have to say, learned over the years that I'm not going to sit and yell in the wind to everyone because people need to come to this conclusion on their own. There are some people, I mean, one of my favorite things to say in my practice, and all my clients know this, is I'm going to say something, but I'm not going to say that it's going to help you today. It might help you 3 weeks from now, a month from now, a year from now, 3 days from now. But I always say, just, you know, open up your little hair. I'm going to plant a seed. I'm going to plant it right here on the top of your head because it's something that I feel is true. And then eventually those roots from that little seed are going to grow into your brain and you're going to get it intellectually. And then eventually those roots are going to grow into your heart. And when those roots get to your heart, you are going to really see why it's helpful to follow this path. But people need time, and it's not, and people are not always ready to appreciate the power of healing through this kind of work.
Yes.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Okay, so we only have 7 minutes more, and I'd like to get to your story, but I think it needs more than 7 minutes.
Which one? Oh, my, yeah, that.
Yeah, does. Example number four, there's only one left.
Oh, man, I forgot about that one. Oh, God. Why did I write this goddamn book? No, I'm just I think if we're going to dive into that, it's going to let, you know what, Forrest, we can do? Okay, so so we were going to do 6 and 7 today, and obviously we're not getting to that.
Yeah, yep. 7 ain't going to happen.
If you're comfortable, I mean, this is the thing. This book group is going to be as long as it is, and the only person that might drop out would be me, right? Like, I mean, you were telling me. I mean, I'll keep coming. So I guess what I'm trying
to... Okay, okay.
We can take time about it because process is incredibly important to me.
So important.
We can't get through that.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you guys want me to talk about that example of me, which I am happy to do, it's you know, it's already 5 of 10 and, you know, I got to get home. So I would say this would be a good point. I'm happy to take questions, but I don't think we should delve into more content right now.
I think you're right. I think that is correct. But what this does mean is that we do have time to talk about the Holmes and Ray life stress scale. Are you familiar with that?
I'm actually not. I mean, I'm sure if you gave me a 2 minute, you know, capsule of it, I could figure it out, but I'm not familiar.
2 minute summary it is then. Rahe was a psychiatrist in the 60s. He's actually still alive and kicking. I've talked to him on the phone. Worked for the Navy, studying what made people sick, and he made a stress scale, and then he did statistics to see how various levels of life adjustment issues would make you increase the chance of you seeing a doctor. And the list is included in the mind-body prescription. So everything is on a scale of 1 to 100. So the awesome. Most, the thing, the life adjustment that would is 100 that will cause the most damage to your health is death of a spouse. And Ray, if anyone wants to Google it, you just type in Holmes and Ray TMS Wiki, and we have the chart as well as an updated chart. So death of the spouse is 100 life change units, divorce is 73, marital separation is 65, imprisonment
is
6.
I remember this now.
Yeah, and then it goes all the way down to sometimes even positive things can cause us stress. A vacation is 13 life change units. Christmas is 12, and a minor violation of the law is 11.
Not for me.
You're liking those vacations, eh?
Yeah, I like my vacations, and I violate the law all the time, and I don't care. But anyway, go on.
So, we'll, Tom, do you want to state your question in your own words?
Well, yes, thank you. You know, often there's big fights at the boards, not this board, the other board, about the science, that there's no science for TMS. It's just conjecture. No, I always say the science is the Rahe Holmes chart. And I first discovered it through Dr. Sarno, where he mentioned in his book, and there's a science. They say, have you had any of these events in the last year, like death of the spouse, things like that? And those are the events, the life-changing events that added up. And then added to our personality, and then added to what's going on today, when you add all those together, tip the reservoir, overflow the reservoir of tension. And I think to me that is the science behind it. And Nicole, I really highly recommend, I think it's helpful to you to take a look at that list. It's very simple, one-page list. And if your clients have had these events in the past year or so, then that could be what is creating their symptoms, because it put them over the edge where they need the protection of TMS from, losing it.
I, to be honest, it's very hard to hear him, Forrest. I didn't hear everything he said, but I have a feeling that I have an idea of where that's going, and I can speak to that. I guess what I want to say in general about this entire topic is, each one of us is an individual. Regardless of what's going on in the world, everything is relative. And so whatever's going on in your life, whether it's something as horrible as the death of a spouse or something as minimal as going on vacation, you have your life, your problems, your stressors. And the very bottom line for me is, be true to yourself and let your life unfold. If X stresses you, then X is important. And I think that too many people say, oh, my problem doesn't compare to so-and-so's, or, you know, there are starving children in Africa. And yeah, and there are, and that sucks. And, you know, if you have money, give to those children. But you need to also understand that your problems are just as important. Your truths and your need for support is just as important. Just even though there are a lot of people who have shitty lives, it doesn't matter. You know, this is the one life we get. I don't know what happens after we die. I'm hopeful that there's something, but I'm just saying this life that we can control and talk about right now is the one. It's the one you get. And so you should honor the things that upset you or excite you or make you feel or think to the utmost, because this is yours. And if you don't honor it, nobody else is going to. And so I think when I hear about that scale, I don't disagree with anything. I mean, it's great. I just want people to understand that, to me, exemplifies the fact that we each need to look at our lives and decide what's important to each of us and how we can be as truthful to ourselves about how we feel on all the topics of our lives. And that will be our salvation against something like TMS.
So it really comes down to your own experience. It's kind of like all pain exists only in the brain. Just like all physical pain exists only in the brain, all emotional pain is about what's traumatic for us.
And also, Forrest, I think what people forget is everything exists only in the brain. Everything. You can't live without what it's doing. You know, I know that our hearts are important, our organs are important, but without our brain to decide, you know, people, that's why people who are quote unquote brain dead get the machines turned off. Our bodies are our brains. Our lives are our brains. We don't do very well without them. And so it's important to honor whatever it is that is going on within our brains in every, you know, in every facet of our lives. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No. And maybe that's how we end the show, this week's show, on that notion of, so as you're doing your own journal speak tonight, and in the coming week, and I hope that people are starting to do that. I hope that you'll think about what matters to you and how it made you feel. 'Cause as Nicole is saying, that's really important.
Yep. Yes, sir.
All right, folks. Well, we have reached the end of another show. Thanks so much for joining us, and thank you, everyone who piped up. You can always, I encourage people who are calling in on the phone to connect, to try using the Fuse meeting. It's nice to be able to use the little chat room. If anyone has any questions and they don't want to speak up with their voice, you can always type stuff up in the chat room.
Yeah, that's helpful. I read it.
Because Nicole is in here via video as well. And if anyone has any questions about connecting, feel free to send me an email beforehand or anytime, really, forest@tmswiki.org, and we will help you out. Until then, thanks for joining. Bye, all.
Peace.
Peace out. All right. Talk to you later.